the biggest thing that I've seen over the years that's really influenced, you know, horses in a negative way is just not understanding pressure, whether it be environmental pressure and human-directed pressure. And they don't understand education very well, but they get hammered with it all the time. So, but you change education and make it a very good, prosperous thing for them, and the trust just, you know, they'll want to come to you in the paddock.
Hello, welcome to Mark Langley's Horsemanship Podcast, a podcast helping people to understand their horses better, to provide solutions in a calm, connected way. I'm Jenny Barnes.
And I'm Mark Langley.
We are going to dedicate this podcast to establishing some clear concepts with Mark's horsemanship. This is going to be especially great for any of you new to Mark. Perhaps you have a new horse or you're new to the membership and you're just not quite sure where to begin. We're going to cover concepts that you might use from the start of converting into Mark's training. So these are the sort of the beginnings of what you might do in a training session or your training journey. Mark's going to clarify what he's trying to achieve and how to achieve it. So to begin with, we'll start off with one of your very first concepts, Mark. How you introduce people to the idea of being a tree. And what do you mean by this? What do you mean by being a tree?
The biggest, thing I want people to understand about being a tree is being very grounded, believing in yourself and where you are, and the ground that you're moving on or standing on. So it's not necessarily we're just standing still. It's we're rooting into the ground when we're walking. We own our steps. And I always see trees as they're very strong but very peaceful and very kind. You know, there's that feeling of peace in a tree. So there's a feeling of peace in us, but there's still a strength and in a tree. So I want people to just have that strength. And like there's a little saying that goes with it is, you know, sometimes we can spend a lot of time moving our horse's feet, but I think one of the biggest keys is the horse not moving our feet. And when we're a tree, you know, we own the ground that we're standing on and we root into that ground, whether we're walking and moving, whether we're standing still. And as I reiterate, it's a sense of peace and calmness, but yet an inner strength in us that the horse is aware of.
All right, so if you've got a horse that perhaps feels a little bit of a big horse, and that's a lovely description that's come from Debbie from Australia, who sent in this big question to us. You know, it's not a horse that follows you around and feels quite passive and interested in what you're doing. It definitely pushes itself on you. It's used to moving you around. And you sort of introduce this concept of being a tree in your challenge series. And in the first part of that, you want people to go out in the paddock and be this tree. How do you establish that sort of sense of leadership through being a tree? You know, do you have to create any sense of worry at the same time, or do you literally just stand there? Can you just explain how that works?
Okay, so I've had occasions where, you know, quite a lot of occasions actually, where I've got someone just to become very grounded. Imagine they're growing their roots into the ground, quieten their mind and become very strong and centered, and their horses have felt that and then stopped pushing on them and they didn't have to do anything. But in turn, I've also had a lot of horses that had no awareness of where the person was, and no matter how grounded and how the person tried to be grounded, and the horse didn't have enough awareness, so they were still pushing on the person, and then they became like the rubbing tree. Which you don't want to become the rubbing tree. So in the sense of the horse not noticing us when we're trying to strengthen and ground ourselves, then we create awareness. So that's where we might do something quite big just to sort of distract the horse and go, hey, you know, I'm here. Now, how you do that is quite important. Like if you don't create enough awareness at the start, it just becomes a white noise, and then you dull the horse to things and they become less aware. So I do something sort of as the horse interrupts the maybe an area that I might be a safe area. So say, for instance, I might just say to someone, okay, well, just make an area around you that's about a meter. And that area, if the horse touches that aware area and it looks like it's unaware, then do something to say, hey, you just touch that area, get some awareness. So basically that's where I might pop a flag really quickly, or I might, you know, get my both hands and bang them on my hips, like, or my legs, and make a clap like I just did then. Enough to create a change of thought in the horse and an awareness. It's not to say get out of here. It's not to say I'm dominant. It's just to say be aware of me and be aware of my space. And then you just go back to silence. And it's the silence in between, especially with dull horses or horses that have got chatter on in their mind all the time. It's that silence in between that actually creates more awareness. And we can all sort of, you know, where there's moments where sometime in your life someone's told you to sort of just go very quiet and just see if you can tune into the environment around you, and you'll be amazed what you can tune into inside yourself, and also the distant noises and smells and things that you don't usually tune into. So, you know, when we've created awareness in a horse, it's essential also to have that quietness of that peaceful tree in between, because it's through that silence that the horse will tune in and become a lot more, you know, they'll start to notice the subtle things. But you have to do something big enough to make a clear enough change. And sometimes, and everybody has to be careful with this, you do something that could be slightly bigger but not big enough to, you know, send them to the moon. But if you don't do it big enough, there's no sense of responsibility, and you can start to manage that horse and manage your own boundaries all the time. So if you do it big enough to create a sense of a slightly higher sense of awareness in your horse, then it starts to tune into its own awareness and stay aware for longer. So you do less for longer. Whereas if you don't do enough, you only just say that's my boundary, but the horse isn't aware enough to sort of take on its own responsibility. So you have to do it to hand responsibility back to your horse, not you kind of manage your boundaries all the time.
Okay, when you first started talking then, you talked about a horse that might be effective with you just growing your roots into the ground. And there it was aware, it was able to become aware of your own thoughts, your own presence of mind and clarity of mind, and it had an effect on the horse. And then you get horses that needed a little bit more help to be able to get into that clear frame of mind. Two different types of horses. And I can, you know, there'll be thousands of examples of different horses out there. Now that's key, isn't it, with your style of training, is that it's horse specific. So if you're training your horse, you need to be able to pick through what Mark is saying. Sometimes he'll say one thing and sometimes he'll say, but you might also need to do this, and you've got to work out what's appropriate for you. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah. Joke I make at clinics is I'm allowed to contradict myself because I got the microphone on. And it just makes people realise that during that clinic that they're watching, I will contradict myself and I'll say one thing, and then a little bit later it'll sound like a contradiction, but it's not a contradiction. It's just a different horse that I'm working, and I have to do the opposite with that horse. But in most cases, the thing that I said before is correct with most horses.
So the principles remain the same?
The principles are the same.
It's just how you're getting there.
Yeah. Like some people I've said, you know, don't drive your horse, but there's, you know, I might say to someone, no, you might have to step into that horse and move it quietly away. And because that horse is not noticing anything. But I wouldn't encourage everyone just to drive horses just to motivate them.
Okay. All right. And one of the other areas that you're talking about a lot is gaining trust in horses. Now, this is quite a key part of your training. You're wanting them to come on board with what we're doing. We don't want to create this idea of them sort of increasing, you know, them wanting to be away from us because our training is sort of quite hard, or it's, we know it's just for that moment to get them to do certain things and then they can go back in the paddock and have a nice life. We actually want them to have a nice life in the training moment. So that involves them trusting a lot of the skills and what we're asking them to do. Can you talk just briefly about a couple of areas of how you actually gain that trust with a horse?
Trust is something that one of the first things in trust is, I think, clarity. Okay, because, you know, we can be friends with someone, but we can't trust them because sometimes they're unclear and we don't know where their boundaries are. You know, when they're having a bad day, they're a bit snappy, so we're sort of standoffish with them. And then when they're having a good day, we're really like hanging around them. And so clarity is the first key in trust. And I think just being clear, having a good intention to want to help your horse, you know, you're smiling on the inside, you don't get kind of caught up in all the emotions that the horse is riding all the time, you know, with you. And you know, you're clear with your boundaries, all those sorts of things build trust in a horse. You know, sort of sometimes we think our connection is the key, and it is one of the key factors in trust too. So we need a connection. So, but a horse doesn't trust what it's unsure of, and a horse gets that surety through the clarity of the things that we're doing. So the clarity creates a surety, surety creates trust, and then connection is that horse hanging around a person or another horse, if it was trusting another horse, if that was an example, that offers a safe feeling of clarity. And there's the feeling of strength. So a lot of horses like to follow the horse that makes a good decision, that when there's conflict, it generally stays fairly stable. So, you know, if there's any emotional conflict or anything happening out whatever, you are always stable. And that's why I say that stability is that clarity that the horse needs, that you're okay when things are going wrong. So horses will seek safety in numbers, but they will tend to follow a horse that makes, or the horse that makes good decisions. They're happy to hand over that too. But you can get out, you know, you can get too much into you help your horse all the time, and they just fall in. They just trust you all the time. So trust is not the key to a horse's empowerment, but it's one of the solid things that you need to have that feeling of safety around you and your education. So clarity, you know, you're calm, your emotions don't go up and down. You offer the things that the horse needs, not necessarily the things that they want. Sometimes people give their horse a scratch because the horse suddenly wants a scratch, but the last owner scratched it when the horse was anxious, so it brings this anxiety over, and then you scratch it. So that's not going to build trust. That's just giving the horse something that it wants. If you see that horse come to get scratched and it's anxious, then you do something to let it go of the anxiety. So you've given it something that it needs. And there's a certain sort of trust in education that we offer horses that show them very quickly how to get out of emotional turmoil. So this is where good education comes in, trust. So you can't have a trust in an animal if you're educating it, and there's that lack of clarity in education. There's also there's no way that horse is letting go of anxiety by the way you're training it and things like that. So,
okay, so a lot of your training is teaching people what to do around horses so that they can, you know, they can use training techniques which are really positive for the horse in terms of how they're feeling about you. But you're also working on the person so that they can become a better leader and they can really be you know, as clear as possible in the directions that they're giving.
Yep.
So there's a lot in, there's sort of two sides to the training as well. It's what the person's doing and also what the horse is doing. And of course that overlaps the moment the person acknowledges how the horse is feeling. So, and how the horse is feeling is, and their level of understanding dictates what training we're doing. There's no set program. There's no goal in the sense of today we're going to do canter transitions. Well, no, today we're going to see what the horse needs, what it doesn't understand. And that moment could happen the moment you put that lead on and it doesn't come softly to the lead, or it could come the moment that you're asking it to do a certain turn and it doesn't turn its with its thoughts. Mm-hmm. Is that right? So we're sort of very in the moment. Our training is very fluid.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. So yeah, and it's a holistic thing. It's how we are, our horses trust that person, how we introduce education to them, and how we expand their knowledge. And the trust, they have to trust the information that we're providing them with. And so, yeah, it's I over the years of doing clinics, to be honest, I've spent more time getting horses to trust their owners by teaching their owners to educate their horses in a better way. And then if I see the person really falls short in their inner strength, then I work on that. But you know, I'm not sort of spending, you know, hours with people sitting on stools at clinics working on sort of some sort of trust and connection, because
it comes through the training.
It comes through the training. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that you do at home. You spend time with your horses and you go out and you have that nice social time with them. So they trust that there's a bit of time there where they're just social with you and nice. But the biggest thing that I've seen over the years, it's really influenced, you know, horses in a negative way, is just not understanding pressure, whether it be environmental pressure and human directed pressure, and they don't understand education very well, but they get hammered with it all the time. So, but you change education and make it a very good, prosperous thing for them, and the trust just, you know, they'll want to come to you in the paddock because you're just good to be around all the time. And some people are very good to be around. Like, I have that joke about your horse likes you in your pajamas, but when you go out in your riding boots, your horse doesn't like you. So it trusts your pajamas, but it doesn't trust your riding clothes. Why? It's because the education of the rider is not the same person that goes out in the pajamas.
Right, okay. So there's a bit of a distinction. And that distinction is the same with your training, in the sense that there's a time for work and there's a time for other things. Is that right?
Yeah, but within work, we are the same person, and our education helps the horse feel good. Not just our padding and scratching and connection stuff.
Right, right.
Our education makes our horse feel good. And some people have mastered, you know, doing nice things with their horse and their horse likes it, but they haven't mastered the education, so they've got this split personality, and then okay. The horse cannot trust a split personality. You can't have the person who trains a horse and makes it feel bad and then goes and makes up for it by you know, going out in the paddock and spending time with it.
Okay. And one of the reasons why, when you jump onto our membership and you sort of get a glimpse of all the different videos that Mark you've put out there on social media, you know, and there's a lot of content, and you can sort of go, my goodness, where's the common thread in all this? What am I meant to be doing next? Well, it's deliberately not laid out like that, because we want to give you the information so that when you're out there and your horse does something, you actually understand these concepts so that you can kind of just respond, as opposed to, you know, again, trying to get that result. So that's why it's a wealth of information. You almost need to immerse yourself in sort of the basics, really, and then it will become clearer as you go, because you're looking for problems and then how you can solve them. So it's a different way of looking at your horse, isn't it? It's a completely different way.
I guess the aim of a teacher, and I guess I'd fall in the category of a teacher more than a trainer these days, because the amount of teaching that I'm doing with people, and is I don't want students to remember the words and the program that, you know, I don't want people to remember the steps that I put in place. I want people to think for themselves, and I want them to go out and remember some of the ideas, the philosophies, the way I help them, and be able to analyse themselves, because I have spent a lot of time doing clinics, fixing programmed horses that have gone through programs where it was always just so. I want people to look at things and go, well, maybe that number two that you thought you were just about to do may not be right for that horse right now, and you might have to do something different. And it is harder for people to take on board, but I think everyone wants to be able to go out and go, you know, think for themselves and not have to look for the answer all the time in everything. You know, go back and look at the text. Just watch and observe. And I think if you watch the videos and you listen to me at clinics and on the podcast, I'd like to think you go out and you analyse, you know, you look at things, you look at what the horse is talking to you, what it's telling you, and try and figure stuff out a bit.
Okay, and so we're going to go back to sort of being a little bit more specific with some concepts of yours. The flag work, I know you talked about it earlier. Are you sort of happy with people waving flags around as part of their horse training?
Am I happy with it? Am I happy with, well, over the years I've seen a lot of very, very damaged horses through everyone buying a flag and going and using it, or buying a round yard and a flag and then sending horses around from a flag. So I'm not happy with people, you know, going and making horses worry a lot with flags and not being able to make them feel good. That's what I worry about. I worry about the anxiety a flag can create, but the person not necessarily having the understanding or ability to get the horse to soften and feel good with the flag. So a flag's there to create clarity, to sometimes make a neutral awareness in a horse, so you're not needing to use your body language. You can pop a flag, create awareness in the air, and then with that awareness you can sort of guide a horse or something like that. It's there to sort of create a a stimulated anxiety. So when you go out, there's a lot of anxieties that you can't control that happen in the environment, and you can use a flag to stimulate anxiety, which is kind of like this neutral anxiety floating in the air. And then when the horse is kind of going, I'm not sure what to do, you go, well, I can help you learn to lead, or I can help you do this, and I can help you feel better. So the whole idea with this flag is to, as I say, sometimes offer more clarity, but also offer an awareness in the horse, and sometimes an anxiety that you can help them through. And if you don't think you can help your horse through, then don't use the flag. But when people go and use a flag, or if I've offered someone a flag lesson with their horse, I say, just be careful how you use this, because, you know, if you under or overdo it, you could create a problem.
All right. So this particular lady, Deb, she said that, you know, her horse isn't really worried by the flag anymore. She's more interested in sniffing it, and she doesn't seem to be able to make it snap like you do. So she sort of feels like a horse thinks she's a bit of a joke. Have you got any tips there on how she can use that flag more effectively?
Yeah. How can she use the flag more effectively? Well, the first thing is that the flag I like to use is just on the end of a light dressage stick with a kind of fairly hard, sort of, you know, more rigid, not too rigid, but not those real light plastic. And I can just, it's really light, so I can pop it really quick. If you buy one of those big heavy horsemanship flags that are, you know, on big steel things, or, you know, the big sort of fiberglass rods, then you're it's like wielding a broadsword versus one of those sort of, you know, fencing swords.
Which we can all relate to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So there's plenty of movies on Netflix now that go back into the, you know, sword fighting days, and, you know, you don't want to have arms like Conan the Barbarian just to swing a flag. So
it's a great tip.
So basically I like them light and whippy, so I can just pop it really quickly and create a little shock in the air that shocks a horse out of a hard thought, and then you open them up to opportunity of search. So the horses, like...
Maybe practice without your horse, get that flag making that crack. And one of the things I've also noticed with you with your flag is that you are very still with it. So I often watch you, and you'll stand there and maybe you'll slightly lean forward. Your hands might be, you know, resting in your pockets, but you're very deliberate that your body language is actually very still. Until you ask the horse to do something, then you become quite big and this flag goes, and you might stand up straight and then you go quiet again.
Yeah.
And I think that's just really key, as well as keeping that flag pointed away from the horse, isn't it? That's quite deliberate.
Yeah. So have you ever sort of, I've been listening to The Rage as Apprentice a bit with, my kids got me onto it, my daughter in particular.
This is a series by John Flanagan, if anyone's interested. It's great for kids.
What podcast do I listen to? Oh, the ones that the kids tell me are good stories. and the art of not being seen is not moving. Okay, so if you were getting, you know, hunted by someone or a ranger, and they were good at invisibility, your awareness when they stop and disappear into the sort of blend into the sort of the background would be so heightened, you'd notice every single movement out there. So that's what I said, you know, before, the art of creating awareness in a horse is the silence in between when you get them to let go of a thought. If you're noisy in between and the movement and too much, you know, white noise, the horse just dulls to that and they don't have to sort of heighten their awareness. So it's that quiet body language that, and then all of a sudden, if you can create a little sort of sonic boom that goes, they go, what was that? And you go, I don't know. Where did that come from? And they go, oh, gee, I better be aware. So if it's quick when you're getting awareness, it's not as dangerous as if you're just going ballistic with a flag and scaring your horse over a fence. So sometimes that quick, sharp, that the horse didn't expect. So sometimes I deliberately do it that the horse didn't expect it, and then they get their own natural awarenesses. And as I said earlier on, that then they become responsible instead of us becoming responsible. You know, you don't want to desensitize a horse so much so that it's kind of asleep and it's just, there's nothing out there that can sort of go wrong, because those horses that think in a training environment that there's nothing that can go wrong, they get out into a real environment and everything goes wrong and they just go ballistic because they don't have any tools to cope with it. And that's the problem with desensitizing and flooding horses, you know, from stables to rugs to overhandling to over-grooming to over-scratching to over-everythinging with human stuff, that they think that there's no danger in their environment at all until they go out into an environment that's got a whole bunch of stuff happening, and then because they were so dull, they get over-faced to the world, and then it's really dangerous.
So I'm just going to pick you up on that one. So you said then that the horse is dull. So let's just be clear on that image. So you've got a horse that has had different things put on it, human things. So whether that's a tarp, whether it's a rug, whether it's a whole load of ropes, desensitizing it. It learns to, the traditional way of desensitizing is that you want the horse to stand still. That's your goal, isn't it? So that you can do this stuff to it. And lo and behold, it's a quiet horse. So the head, the mind of the horse goes inside internally, doesn't it? That's what you're seeing, and you describe it as a dull horse. Can you just talk very quickly about that?
Yeah. So they just go, okay, I if I can't move, I won't think. So after a time, so basically, human psychology would be the same. Someone who's been in a car accident, they put him in a wheelchair. They either figure out what they can do in a wheelchair, or they get in the doldrums and go, oh, I don't want to go out anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. My life's over. I can't move. I can't do what I used to do. So horses are the same. If you take away movement too early, especially when there's still anxiety in them, then they can get into the dark place of shutdown.
So that makes a lot of sense, because horses are constantly moving in terms of they are a flight animal. So yes, to take that one sensory processing, not sensory processing, but that very natural ability away from them really does would change who they are.
Yep. So the interesting thing about it, like, and I've seen plenty of shutdown horses move, but they never move with the quality, the softness, the alertness, and the good feeling of a horse that's completely present. They move with stillness, even though they might be moving fast, their movement's braced and heavy. Everything's kind of like rigid in them, and they break down early and stuff like that. So they've learnt to move with a closed up mind. But what closes the mind up in horses is lack of movement and lack of going towards their thoughts. So that's one of the biggest keys in keeping a horse open, is they made the decision to move their feet, and their feet are supporting their thought. They're not just thinking in one direction, going in the other with their feet. So taking movement away, like you said, from a flight animal is very dangerous, because so what I say is, it's okay to have a thought, but how are you going to support that thought? How's a horse support its thoughts? Through movement. It does something. So basically, it does something when it has a thought, and the 90% of the thoughts a horse has are going to be through something that it's doing and somewhere where it's moving. Okay, so if a botfly lands on a horse, it does something about it. If you made a horse stand completely still forever with a botfly on it, it'd just zone out to botflies.
Mark, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit, and just, you know, a bit of a story for us, because I've seen you at clinics and I've seen you show people, you know, owners actually might not have been aware of their horse in the sense that it's dull, but you sort of bring on this new concept and a new way of looking at a horse. We call it sort of looking through a different lens, and it really is, you just see horses in a different way once you sort of, you know, listen to you talking for a while. So a horse, you know, might come into a clinic and you might go, your horse is shut down, and look, and you'll touch it on the back, and I've seen you, and the horse, there's no response, but then at the end of the lesson you've stimulated it, and what happens? Can you just...
Well, there's a few horses I'll be sort of, you know, whether it be girthing up, I'll say, see, I'm girthing up the horse and there's nothing. And as you said, see, I'm going over the horse, there's nothing. And I wave a flag, there's nothing.
So dull eyes, dull ears, dull maybe ears, a lowered just, head.
Maybe not even obvious. Ears not moving much, yep. Looking very still. A lot of the real shutdown ones don't, they're kind of a bit more like a statue. But by the end of it, you'll kind of run your hand just over their fur, and you'll feel the muscles kind of working as you're working down, and you'll feel little twitches in their body. You'll feel their ear flick on your hand as it's going down and all the way down to the hind foot or anything like that. And that's when you know they're aware, and they're sort of aware of you, like a fly lands on them and knows exactly where it is and where to flick their skin to sort of get that fly to come off. So they get that sort of higher level of awareness. And, you know, horses aren't lazy, like all these horses. Most every horse I've met that has been deemed lazy has just lacked awareness, and education sort of flooded it to shut it down or something like that, overwhelmed it. They've been pushed past their processing speed, all sorts of things. And but you can bring them back to life. That's the best thing about it. You can bring them all back to life again. I do sort of try very hard to get people to understand how we can shift the mindset, then train the horse, not just train the horse in the wrong mindset. So, and you know, a lot of the time it is creating that natural awareness in our horse.
Okay, so I'm a mother. I've got children. You're his father. You've got kids. Our kids together.
Our kids.
That, you know, the back of people's minds, they might be going, I want a quiet horse. I'm not sure I like the idea of this high flight response animal being even more aware. Can you just reassure people on what you're trying to achieve?
A horse that is frightened and lacks awareness and has strong thoughts and supports those thoughts with movement, so not the ones that haven't shut down, that are frightened and unaware, can be dangerous. So yes, an aware horse can be dangerous, but it's an uneducated aware horse and it's got a lot of anxiety and it's constantly in a sort of a high flight mode, but it's not sort of seeing any boundaries. So its immediate awareness is not very good, but its flight instinct to be elsewhere is strong. Those horses are dangerous because they run over kids, they run over parents, they do all sorts of things like that. The shutdown horses are just as dangerous because you don't know when something's going to happen. But when it happens, if they're holding a lot of that negative emotion in like a pressure cooker, it comes out big and dangerous. And it could be the time when one of your little kids is behind it and then all of a sudden a door slams and it didn't
pop.
And then all of a sudden it pops, pulls back, nearly flips over backwards, you know, drags a rail, whatever. So those horses that, and some never do it. Some spend their whole life shut down and something doesn't happen quite enough. But most of the ones that I've met that have never pulled back, never done this, when they're out on a trail ride, they don't walk. They're kind of hot and they're worried and they might sweat in floats and there's all these things that they do that, you know, say, oh, my horse is so quiet. And you go, well, tell me what it does on trail. Well, actually, that's the only time when I have trouble and, you know, and I spend the whole time sort of trying to hold it back. So they do come out in different sort of situations, but the soft aware horse, right? I used to watch our kids and times, you know, when you think, oh, crikey, on a farm, you've got to get the kids away from tractors, vehicles. Oh, no, they've just wandered through the young horses, the wild horses just come in and you watch them sort of walk through the horses and the horses were all curious and I never saw the horses, you know, even the ones that had not a lot of interaction with people, do something malicious, though I'm not saying they're not going to, and you could have some protective stallion see a kid come through or whatever that's been chased by dogs and attack your kid. But in most cases, I've seen a lot of unhumanized horses just going, oh, that's a bit scary, that thing over there. But a horse trusts what doesn't cause that conflict and that fear in them, okay? So if we can, you know, not be the flight animal that chases our horse all the time, then they'll start to trust us. And if they're aware, they'll know where we are. So when they jump, they won't jump over us. And if we create an awareness around humans where our space, like going back to the tree, our space is important. We own that space. So I don't have some sort of mutual agreement where sometimes the horse can push me and sometimes I push them, in the sense of being safe around little people, big horses around little people. It's essential that a horse does not take our space, okay? They don't just suddenly shift us and we move. And that's why being tree-like around horses, every person becomes a tree, from the toddler to the, you know, to the big tall person, and a horse can't take their space. But I don't teach people to chase their horses around and say to be the alpha, you've got to move their feet away from you, because that puts them in flight mode and then they become suspicious around people and nervous and worried what too many people in one place, and they become paranoid because who's going to chase them next.
Lovely. I think we're getting a really good sense of, you know, this mindset that you are aiming for in the horse, and that's his key. Mm. It's getting the right mindset, one that they're learning and they're open to information, but also they're going to be a whole lot safer around you, both on the ground and under saddle, because they're just more sensible, because they understand, they can process, and they don't revert to these extremes that you've been talking about, whether that's the flight or the shutdownness. And you mentioned their soft awareness. If we can just maintain that in our minds, that's what we're trying to get. When you wave the flag, it's an awareness, but it's not, you know, it's not a dominating, it's not yep, going to be detrimental.
Just quickly, the important thing that creates safety with the open horses is that sense of awareness, is a feeling of empowerment that if something happens, they can do something. And that's why those horses are softer in higher anxious environments around people because they've been able to manage and able to do something when things get a little bit more dangerous. So they actually don't get as anxious when things happen.
So that would be important to practice that in the training session so that when you get in that situation where it is heightened outside, they know yeah. that they can make those decisions.
Most of the horses that are a bit shut down and or extremely shut down or whatever, they seem very quiet, but the reason they aren't quiet when things go wrong is because they've been feeling so trapped that they don't feel that they have a natural flight instinct or ability to make a decision around threats. So when a person takes them into a threatening environment, they're really dangerous because they've always been thinking, you're not allowed to do anything, don't do anything, and that really creates anxiety in them when they feel stressed because it's like there's a lion and I'm not allowed to do anything about it. Too much, I'm out. So they usually go straight to big flight instead of making little decisions earlier.
And that's a really good point because I have seen with your training that you're very much about, it's not about don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. It's about do, let's do this. And you offer alternatives all the time. Yep. That'll come through as you start to sort of watch and get into Mark's training. You know, how does he get the different mindsets? How does he change them? And what's he doing to sort of to empower horses? You mentioned that before, you know, and help them to sort of feel that confidence that enables them to make decisions. It's all about what they do. All right, I'm going to go back because we've come off track a little bit, but I hope this is interesting for everyone out there listening. We're going to go back on track to these sort of specific scenarios just so that you can offer that clarification. You know, and a lot of people sort of get into you and they start to look at their horses in a different way, like I mentioned, or they might sort of start to notice things they didn't notice before. And a common one is, you know, how they travel. So you might have said, oh, yeah, they go on the float fine. But now you're realising that, well, actually, they rush off. And you're saying that's not good because that is an issue. And so you start to look at that and you sort of realise, oh, yeah, they're bracing that float or they're lifting their head up, you know, all the time. Something's not quite right. And so they start to look into floating and or loading and how you can improve that and get them comfortable in there. And of course, they fall back on this, what you always sort of seem to come back round to in so many different scenarios is the quality of leading. So yes, just to underline the links that you may or may not have formed in your mind, if you want to have a successful loading experience and traveling experience, it's leading you want to work on.
Yes. Yeah, because leading is so... leading is the key to teaching a horse that it has, it's safe within boundaries and it has a guidance system through leading that's taught it to be soft and thoughtful. And it's trusting leading that, completely trusting leading in the halter that's on that horse's head, that helps them go in there with something that they're not frightened of. The horses that don't know how to lead properly are still conflicted with boundaries they don't understand. There's a rope on them they haven't fully understand. So they're actually loading into the float with something that they don't understand or like very much. So it adds to the stress in the float. So when someone's put a headstall or a halter on a horse's head and said, I'm going to do some, you sniff the float and I'm going to wait and I'm going to sniff the float and wait, and the horse eventually goes in, it's going there in there with a little monster on its head because they didn't spend enough time teaching it how to understand that little monster on its head's not a monster. So I've seen horses that are pulled back in the past and when you put a halter on them, they're a bit twitchy, and when you lead them, there's a bit of wariness in there, and they got to carry that little monster on their head into a float, which they are scared of as well. So they've got two monsters afloat around them and one on their head. So if you're going to just work a horse and to load it, do it at liberty without anything on it and go into a float that it can't hurt itself in, but if you choose to put a halter on a horse's head, you choose to empower it with that halter, otherwise don't wear one at all. That's my philosophy.
All right, so you're teaching people how to really use these tools really, really well. Okay, and let's just... I've got this horse that I've had, you know, for years and years and years, and I've always put a halter and a lead rope on it or headstall on it. I do that almost every day, and I put it on and it follows behind me like a little puppy dog. I don't have a problem. And then one day it pulled back in the float. Mm. Can you just link those two scenarios?
Well, a lot of times, a lot of the training that I've seen over the years, and I've even been responsible to doing myself because it was through unlearning I've learned, and through throwing away things that didn't seem to work or didn't the horse didn't feel good about, I tried to sort of try new things. But as a lot of horses associate how to avoid pressure or conflict from the pole or the face from the halter is read the person's body language. And if the horses, which some very sensitive horses are super good at, and or all horses are, but the ones that have been dull don't read much because they're shutting out. But horses are very good at perceiving where the pressure is going to come from, and to avoid it, they'll follow the cue of body language. So we put the halter on, we move our feet forward, the horse follows us. But if you stood still and pulled on that horse and backed and pulled it, it'd probably go, where? I couldn't read that. And then it suddenly pulls back in a big fright. And you go, where'd that come from? It said, well, that time it couldn't predict where the pressure was going to come from. The pressure found it and boom, you had a problem. So
problem in understanding. All right. So yeah, training is all about understanding what we're doing and understanding pressure, feeling good about pressure. Okay, back to these questions. Another scenario that typically happens with people is that they see their horses getting aggressive around feed time. Maybe there's a bit of nasty behavior coming through, maybe they're a bit possessive. Is this something that we need to just stand back and go, well, you know, you just need your space. I'm not worried about these ears coming back at me and they look like they're going to kill me. Or is this something that we need to manage?
There's something you told me some years ago, Jenny, in a book that you read about, you know, when we went from hunter-gatherers to farmers and things like that. And there's some interesting little things in that I thought about. And ownership, you know, now we own a car, we own a house. We work hard for the things we own, and that giving is not, you know, is there in society as much as it once upon a time is. Like once upon a time, I think it was you share what you have, you just share it, and that's the way it is. If you got more, it doesn't matter because the tables will turn another day, and that's the whole idea of, you know, but and horses that grow up on grass and live in a paddock, they just eat, and there's not as much conflict around food because it's just growing out there everywhere and they're just kind of wandering. The horses that are grown up in a lot of human environments and things like that, there's feed times, there's, you know, there's conflict in small yards with horses that they don't want to be close to. And then all of a sudden, you know, and also stable environments and the anxiety in stables and food becomes the only good thing in that horse's day because it's like that one stimulant that makes it feel good. So then there's this kind of like addiction to food because everything else is so bad. So there's not the right balance of good feeling in the horses in their day-to-day routine. So food becomes the one thing, and it's like the day that really excites them. And then so around it, there's a lot of like, oh, food's coming, and there's that. Then the anxiety of treat withholding comes in and kicks in. So the anxiety kicks in, and then so there's a whole bunch of reasons why horses get angry and around food. And I think sometimes we've got to go back and reflect. And if we're going to breed horses or do anything with them, we've got to think about what's the quality of their life right through to make feed not such a big thing. So that's a start. The next thing is what do we do when they're already at that stage? They're already aggressive. Okay, the first thing I do is, like, I've done this a few times. I've done some leading lessons with horses and I've taught them how to let go of strong thoughts with the lead rope. I've sort of worked with them. And then I've had them on a lead and I've introduced food to the situation. And I've said, when you let go of the hard thought around food, maybe we can think about eating, okay? Now, some people might just work on a boundary. So they might say, okay, when the horse stands over there and doesn't do anything and doesn't come in and attack or whatever, or attack other horses or attack me and try and steal the bucket, then I'll let it have its food. Well, I go one step more than that. I go, when you don't want the food and you're soft and your mindset changed, then we might think about eating in a peaceful mindset, just like a peaceful horse eats out in the paddock, and don't just get that food and munch into it, right? So it takes a bit longer, but if you sort of say let go of that thought enough, the horse will reset and then go, and then it'll soften, it'll lick and chew, maybe it'll just go into a peaceful place, and then when it's in that peaceful place, you go and feed it and you teach it to have a soft mindset around food. And that's education. You're not saying don't, you're trying to say do. So you did say don't by saying that's my boundary, don't come in here, but you went one more by saying do feel good.
Now, the next question comes from Helen. She's in a place called Chester in New Hampshire in the USA, and she has a new horse. She's new to the membership as well, so she's just trying to understand everything, and she's wondering if we've got any advice about where she can start off with her new horse as a rescue, and she doesn't know his history. So she's sort of wanting to start off on the groundwork. So Helen, for you, the best place is the challenge, which is a series of exercises that Mark will talk you through that cover all the sorts of things that we've been talking about here. And you talked about one specific thing that you have started to do, which is asking your horse to do a circle around you on the ground. And what happens is that when you ask your horse to go past your shoulder, you're finding that he's stopping and turning into you, which is a very common scenario, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, stopping and turning in certainly is, because sometimes it's because the horse wants to get two eyes on. Sometimes it's because they've been taught to face up and then go on a circle, and the circle's required a fair bit of pressure to send them out. So it takes a lot of pressure to send them out. But when you just lead them by and they've got one eye on, they just go, well, can I face up? So the idea with getting a horse to walk past or go out on a circle is they feel good on a circle. They feel good out on that rope, whether you're offering a straight line, turn, circle, anything. Now, the problem with driving them out too hard is they end up feeling bad. So then what do? They seek up that release of pressure, which is always sometimes in the face up. So they hunt the face up. So I don't know exactly what caused it in your horse. It could be still just a green horse that is a bit not confident down with you down the sides. And either way, it we can talk about both, and it's still kind of the same answer. But basically, don't worry about the horse going past too much first. That's one of the biggest keys, I think, and get softness in the lead. So I don't mind if you work, like something I do is I make a cross with my arms, like I'm making a big cross standing there with my arms out like a cross, and I'll push my hand out like that, and I say, if that line there is one line, the other line is the horse's spine, so from its ears to its tail. And then if you can make a 90-degree angle between, you know, across your shoulder blades to your leading hand, and then from the horse's ears to its tail, and you maintain a rigid kind of 90-degree angle, and you just walk your horse at that angle. You might walk backwards in a straight line for a while, get comfortable with it, and then just stand still and just get the horse to go forwards and backwards at just a few steps, a little bit like that, until it's kind of, you know, moving but not pushing in. And do that on both sides. Another thing is I encourage is lifting and floating lessons. Lifting and floating lessons. So lift the horse out so it moves out. And you're constantly watching that eye. And when that horse gets soft and it wants to carry a forward thought, it'll carry a forward thought out. Now, a lot of horses are focused on us. So because they're focused on us, they're going to push on us. Some horses push on us because they're focused to the outside and they're falling in because everything's pushing them in. What, you know, they're scared of things out there, or the shoulder falls in. So either way, the more you sit, stand in hand and get them to soften and lead, the more they'll let go of the outside thought, become more centered, and then lead by. So it's a matter of not asking him by all in one hit. It's a matter of getting him soft in your hand, trusting, going just with one eye just there, and then slowly working them past you until they walk past soft. Might take you a more than one or two lessons. And whereas when you try and do it all in one hit, they just fall in and face up.
So when you mentioned then that you know, you're getting them to go with their thoughts, to get them to go in that forward, that's a forward thought, that is, you know, your training is getting your horses not to focus on us, but so their thoughts then become more on the environment around them, don't they?
Yeah.
And you sort of talk about this primary and secondary focus. And so they're able to take in information from us, but they're also able to take on their environment. So this is, again, a little bit of a key concept with Mark. His training is not about us and what we're doing and the focus on us. It is very much about having a learning space mindset.
Yes.
Yeah. So Helen, the videos, if you can understand all of that, the videos that you need to be watching are the challenge, because it will talk you through sort of how to build up to these steps. There are also specific videos on the membership leading past the shoulder in detail, teaching a yearling to lead past. And I'll put these links on the Facebook group for you, and encouraging the wither to lift. So these are all sort of videos that you can find on the membership in that leading section, but I'll put them on links for you in the group. And Mark, the final question for you in this sort of unusual sort of quickfire podcast, which is covering a lot of information in a short time, comes from Claire. And Claire is over in the UK. And she would like to know, what is the best way to help a horse not feel trapped in the head collar? We broached on it before, but can you just go in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, I was thinking about that question when I started talking about that.
Yes, I should have mentioned it earlier.
So basically, empowering a horse in the halter, it's about empowerment. You've heard during this conversation about movement is the key to supporting a horse's thought, and horses can sometimes give up thinking if they think that movement's futile or they're not allowed to move. There's a lot of scenarios, and I was trying to explain this at a clinic the other day when I saw this particular horse. It was really trapped in the lead rope. I said, I'll bet my left boot that this horse has been had a holder rope put on it, and when it kind of went to run off, it got pulled to sort of face up, and then when it went off to run off again, it got pulled to face up. So basically, every time that horse had a bit of an escape thought, the rope stopped it. And then the other thing that probably happened, the horse got round penned, so I guarantee that the horse got sent out on a round pen and then pulled to say, come back. Pulled to say come back. So the rope, I said, by the looks of this horse, every time I put the holder on it, it looks like it's in a trap. It's like got a hobble on its mind. Now, it wasn't one of those ones that just pulls back and runs backwards, but it could really lean and really didn't want to move softly. And there was no kind of desire to search when I pulled on the rope. And I said, well, all the energy's come through a push and all the stop running has come through a pull of the rope. So no wonder horses get trapped in a rope, is because it said don't think and chasing said go. So if we can do the opposite of that, the horse will open up. So what I did with that horse, I just held it and kept pulling and pulling and pulling and waiting until it moved a little bit. Now, it didn't even move its thoughts, but it did move its feet a little bit, and I did it again and again until it moved a little bit more. And then all of a sudden, as it moved three or four steps and those steps turned into 2 meters, then all of a sudden the ear flicked and then it started to travel and move. So I said, when I pull on you, I want you to move, not when I pull on you, don't run off. Yeah. So it's that pulling and creating movement that first opens a horse up. Now, they may not think straight away, but once you can get to the feet and they'll move a little bit more, they'll start to move and travel. So a lot of those horses that don't trust leading pressure have found it as a trap. They've found it, all of a sudden it trapped them, but it never stayed there to create the opposite, which is a pathway. So a pathway opposed to a trap. So or an opportunity opposed to a threat. So the reason it becomes a threat is because the horse got all worried about something and then the halter traps it. Okay, so the halter is just as much as,
and they never understood it.
And they never understood it. So all you do is got to keep with the feel. Now, you might just hold the feel slowly for a little while at a long rope, like go on a real long rope and pull and wait. The horse will get frightened, and don't, you know, if it flips over backwards, then you probably pulled too hard or put too much pressure. But if it's one of those horses, if you just touch its head and it flips over, then, which I don't think it is. I think it might be a horse, or because you would have probably said that in the question if it was flipping over every time you pulled it. But I would just wait on a long rope and just wait, and it'll wriggle and it'll shut down a bit, and you just keep moving. You might move off to the side. You might, you know, any of the young horse videos or foal handling has all got part of this, you know, a horse that doesn't know how to lead until it just takes some steps. And then you do it again until it takes some steps. And then all of a sudden that horse will come through to pole pressure. And then when you guide your horse out on circles or any training or anything like that, don't just send it out with a stick to catch it and try and keep it on the circle with the rope, because that's just creating more of a trap. Get the rope, pull it, guide the horse past and let it go out through the feel of a rope. And then if it went out through the feel of a rope, then all the rope's going to do is say, why don't you come back? And when you ask your horse to come back, instead of all the, you know, because it's only gone out to feel, it hasn't run out from a lot of chasing pressure, then technically when you pull on it to come back, it'll go, oh, there's some pressure. And if you think your horse is feeling trapped when you send it out on a circle and you wanted to pull it back, then go for a walk with it. Just keep pulling the rope until the horse turns and follows that rope and goes with it, instead of just trapping it and getting it to face up with two eyes on. And that's another thing that commonly happens, is we pull it, the horse faces up with two eyes on and then gets sent again away from pressure. So we really got to think about, you know, just maintaining a flow with those, with movement. So everywhere that rope goes, the horse goes. Until everywhere you push the rope, the thoughts go, okay? So when the thoughts go, they'll be what moves the feet. But sometimes you just got to get to some sort of movement first.
Okay, well, that's a wrap. Thank you so much to the questions, and I hope that makes sense to any of you out there, the new members and people who are sort of being introduced to Mark, people who are coming on board with his fantastic training techniques that really do make changes on horses. If you're keen to see Mark in action and you actually want to see the change that does happen over an incredibly short space of time, go to his masterclasses. I can't recommend them enough, because you get to see him work with many, many different types of horses and see him address, you know, coming at these different angles, but you know, that just makes it so relevant to so many different people and so interesting to see. So his masterclasses coming up are in Brisbane on the 5th of May and Adelaide on the 26th of May. We've still got a few tickets left, so definitely jump online and grab those while they're still there. Thanks so much, Mark. That was fascinating listening to you as always. And next week we're talking about separation anxiety, so stay tuned for that one.
Thanks, Jenny. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to Australia's very own Mark Langley, a horseman with many insights from his decades of dabbling. Jump online to keep learning. marklangley.com.au